Reflection 4. Protocol Expressions. The Language of Coordination. The protocols we've gone over ensure that interactions follow agreements, making the fairness, efficiency, and integrity of the living system. The protocols maintain the space for interaction. The expression of these protocols can take many forms, which we might call languages. Language enables participants to interact meaningfully within the larger system. In this reflection, we're going to practice looking at how the protocols are expressed in different resource coordination environments. Ecosystems. In Reflection 1, we looked at mycorrhizal networks as a compelling natural model, showcasing the interplay between protocol and network infrastructure in resource coordination. The fungi's selective connection with compatible host plants exhibits what can be seen as a curation process in which specific resources or skills are chosen for inclusion. The fungi absorb nutrients such as phosphorus and nitrogen from the soil, concentrating them in vesicles and making them available to the plants. This initial provision of resources is akin to seeding, where the fungi invest in creating a supportive environment that responds to signals and promotes the growth and health of their plant partners. Seeding, in this light, is the provision of initial resources. Furthermore, the regulation of nutrient holdings and transfer based on plant signals and fungal contributions reflects the limitation or capacity assessment function in common pooled resources, evaluating the community's ability to contribute to and benefit from the resource pool. For example, a farmer contributing surplus crops must ensure that the pool is not overburdened with the same resource, while maintaining enough for others to draw upon where needed. Finally, the dynamic exchange rates between nutrients, fluctuating with availability and demand, parallel the relative valuation protocol function, which assigns a fair value to each resource based on its utility to the community. For instance, a unit of labour in farming may be considered equal to a unit of materials for house construction, balancing contributions and needs. These functions are seamlessly integrated with a sophisticated infrastructure comprising the vast network of hi-fi as intricate communication pathways that enable rapid feedback and resource allocation adjustments. Hi-fi extend into plant root cells to form arbuscules, where they facilitate the efficient exchange of nutrients between the fungus and the plant while also feeding the fungi. In addition to this, the fungi also exhibit what we might call stewardship principles that could be categorized as enabling infrastructure. These are manifested through the chemical regulation via signals which, along with the hyphae, simultaneously facilitate real-time communication and adaptive responses to changing environmental conditions. Ecosystem parasites. Ecosystems have evolved intricate ways of managing parasites, integrating them into the broader web of life. Parasites often begin by exploiting resources, taking advantage of opportunities in a system. While their impact may seem purely harmful, they play critical roles in maintaining ecosystem balance. By controlling host populations, parasites prevent overgrowth and allow resources to be distributed more equitably among other species. The selective pressure drives coevolution, spurring both parasites and hosts to adapt and become more resilient over time. In many cases, parasites indirectly contribute to nutrient recycling, breaking down and redistributing resources that might otherwise remain locked within their hosts. Over time, parasites transition into symbiotic roles, integrating so deeply with the system that they contribute to its overall stability, For example, certain parasites defend the resources they exploit from other invaders, ensuring the survival of their host, and by extension, their own survival. This mutual cultivation and defense of the system can transform what was once a purely exploitative relationship into one of cooperation. Parasites also play key roles in food webs, acting as prey for predators or even as predators themselves, linking the food web and contributing to ecosystem complexity and resilience. In some cases, their influence can shape habitats, earning them the label of ecosystem engineers. Far from being mere disruptors, parasites are integral to the intricate dance of life, highlighting the adaptability and interdependence of living systems. Quote, "Nature doesn't charge us any money. Nature gives us everything for free. All nature asks of us is that we protect it." That's attributed to Davi Kobanawa. Yanomamo, a leader of the Yanomami communities in Brazil. Parasites teach us that even the most exploitative relationships can evolve into symbiotic partnerships, where mutual benefit emerges from what was once conflict. This transformation, however, requires a shift in perspective, from seeing resources as something to extract to recognizing ourselves as integral parts of the systems on which we depend. As Davi Kobenawa Yanomamo eloquently reminds us, nature gives freely but asks us to protect and nurture it in return. The story told above of the Wata and their relationship with elephants illustrates this evolution. What may have begun as a parasitic dynamic, taking from the elephants, matured into a deep interdependence, where the Wata saw themselves as part of the elephant's world. By contrast, the ancient Roman elite may have failed to recognize their connection to the people, whom they called peasants and slaves, on whom their society depended, creating a system of exploitation rather than stewardship. Today, those who control the majority of global capital have fallen into this same trap. Instead of fostering relationships of care and reciprocity with workers and communities, many see them as resources to exploit, replace, or discard. This centralization of power and control enables extraction and undermines the protocol functions inherent in living systems, stopping our ability to connect directly with each other and create common pooled resources. It also erodes the health and resilience of our ecosystems and society. Modern examples, like the criminalization of seed exchange in Kenya, partly as a result of corporate lobbying, highlight how these centralized powers restrict the natural human capacity to exchange directly, pool resources, and build commons. Just as nature's protocols offer inspiration for pathways to balance and sustainability, reclaiming these practices from dominating extractive centralized systems is essential to the creation of equitable, thriving systems. Stewardship is not about domination, but about recognizing ourselves as part of the whole and nurturing the systems that sustain us all. Social systems. Our second exploration of proto-social protocols and infrastructure in Reflection 2 centered on the Mweria system, practiced by the Mijikenda communities on the coast of Kenya. By pooling their commitments to labour and resources, community members can undertake large-scale projects in short time periods that would be hard or impossible to achieve individually, such as building houses, cultivating fields, or managing communal lands. The specific tasks and contributions can also vary depending on the community's needs and skills. Examples include 1. Agriculture, Farmers may take turns helping each other with planting, harvesting, or other labor-intensive tasks. 2. Domestic care. Parents may rotate childcare responsibilities, allowing each parent time for other activities while ensuring that their children receive adequate care. Also common with livestock management. 3. Community projects. Members of a community may take turns contributing their time and skills to complete projects like building a community center, maintaining shared spaces, or organizing events. As I have witnessed, the third example can be applied to pursue sustainable use of communal lands and the preservation of local ecosystems. The pooled labor can be used for efforts aimed at ecosystem restoration, such as mangrove restoration or flood prevention. Built into these traditions are all four protocol functions. 1. Curation. Who and what services will be part of the group pool and allowed to draw on these resources in exchange for what? 2. Relative valuation. How do we ensure that the goods and services we contribute are of fair relative value? 3. Limitation and capacity assessment. What are the capacities of our members so that we can prevent oversupply and overburdening of individuals? 4. Exchange. When and how do we exchange services as part of a mueria, as well as settling debt obligations? The mind of the Kaya. We've discussed the basic protocols for resource pooling in ecosystems and social systems. While understanding these protocols make it easier to replicate them and connect them across larger communities, how do we make sure it's done well and avoids the pitfalls we see in dominating and extractive systems? We've focused on the heart of the Kaya, and now it's time to focus on the mind. With muerias as the heart, reciprocally pumping resources through the Kaya, or the Mijikenda society, over generations, stewardship is brought through the mind of the Kaya in a practice called Dome by the Mijikenda. Dome is a tradition of fireside gatherings by which the agreements, rituals, and norms of the culture are enacted. This is where we find deliberations, settlement of debts, stories, celebrations, histories, and morals taught to children. The full-day agenda of a dome looks something like: call to attend and introductions, singing and dancing, a visit to the sacred forest, start cooking, storytelling, learning songs and skills, weaving and drinking, eating and sending the children off to sleep, serious discussion, settlement of disputes and debts, and warrior planning, singing, dancing and drumming. Then continued discussions can go on till morning. As with a mueria, a dome can be called for many reasons. The role of stewardship is there not only to review curation, membership in the commons, but also to value mutual contributions and limit the risk of imbalances between them. Dome may involve many configurations of attendees, from individual family members through groups of elders to a whole community, coming together to discuss family and community issues, settle debts, tell stories, make commitments and collective decisions, and plan. Elders play a central role in these gatherings, since they are respected for their wisdom, experience, and knowledge of cultural practices. They constitute a revolving council, which serves as the primary decision-making body across a clan. Council membership rotates by age, as well as Kaya members calling on a particular elder. A dome can be called for many reasons, like dealing with a drought or a domestic problem, and the elders that form the council will shift based on many factors, including familiarity with the issues, a history of fairness and wisdom, and so on. We can see the dome itself as an expression of the same protocols as the mueria, In some ways, it seems that the Dome has grown out of the Mueria itself. Rotating stewardship roles means that planning responsibilities are shared collectively, ensuring that more members have a voice, contribute to, and benefit from community resources. The Council's responsibilities include managing communal land, overseeing resource distribution, organizing communal labor, and ensuring that traditional laws and customs are upheld. In this sense, the elders provide stable and effective stewardship that benefits the entire community by pooling their knowledge and collective resources. It also allows for a dynamic and flexible stewardship structure that can adapt to the community's changing needs. Together, the Mueria and Dome, like the heart and mind, support the Kaya as a viable or living system through the following functions. Operations. Mueria organizes core communal labor and resource sharing, delivering the community's essential outputs, e.g., farming or construction. 2. Coordination. Mueria ensures harmony among participants by scheduling and distributing labor equitably to avoid conflicts or redundancy. 3. Control. The Dome provides stewardship for resource use, resolves disputes, and audits commitments, ensuring that the Mueria operates effectively within shared rules. 4. Collective intelligence. The Dome adapts strategies by considering external factors, e.g., droughts or conflicts, and aligning community actions with future needs. 5. Planning and policy. The Dome upholds the community's core values, cultural identity, and long-term well-being, integrating the operational and strategic aspects of Mueria into a unified vision. Social parasites. The ability for a person or a family to be parasitic by extracting large amounts of resources from the commons of a village or clan setting is limited to a single Mueria cycle. If you were helped by the community and didn't support anyone else over a whole season, you would not be helped in the next cycle. As with the biological limitations of ecosystems, it is very hard in such an environment to continually pull from the commons, just as it would be very hard for a pumpkin to keep growing forever. Sadly, we must acknowledge that anything resembling natural limits on parasitic behavior has been breached again and again. The ancient Mijikenda were able to escape the warring Galena tribes in the north and find refuge in the forests for centuries, but eventually most of the social systems of the Mueria were again dismantled by extractive colonial powers. What if our very ability to form new connections and commons is thwarted and all our exchanges are channeled to feed a particular extractive ecosystem, like a giant pumpkin? Where can we all escape to today? Centralization and extraction. Imagine you're an architect designing a house. To build something sturdy, you rely on foundational protocols, like understanding how forces interact, physics, and how shapes distribute weight, geometry. These protocols are at work whether the house stands strong or collapses. A well-built house shows how these protocols are applied effectively, while a collapsing house reveals what happens when they are not. The rules themselves remain constant. The difference lies in how the protocols are followed. While we can identify healthy systems with protocols at work in them, we can also look at systems that have collapsed, continue to fall apart, or exhibit cancerous growth and see the same protocols at work. Let's take a snapshot of where the usage of these protocols broke down. There are many moments to choose from, but let's start with the resource coordination tradition of the Romans that brought us the word money. The rise of monetary systems as exemplified by, but not unique to, the ancient Roman tradition in which coins were used to execute forced taxation, has in many cases led to centralized and extractive resource coordination by the ruling class. The legacy of these traditions continued in colonial tax systems, which were imposed on communities, extracting resources without providing equivalent benefits and violently disrupting ancient cooperative practices like mueria and dome. If ancient Romans were alive today, they would likely recognize remnants or variants of their traditions still co-opted in our usage of money in modern times. National currencies issued by centralized authorities, imbued with terms like "In God We Trust," still serve the purpose of giving divine-like power to the state to collect taxes. When we carefully consider the roots of money, we must acknowledge its deep-seated role in our own history. Growing up surrounded by a monetary system and dependence on state money, we often take money as the only form of resource coordination. Because we are so fixated on money, particularly state money or national currency, it's worth looking at the classically ascribed, but also misleading and narrow, functions of money, namely store of value, unit of account, and medium of exchange, and how these can be seen in common pooled resource networks. The store of value in monetary systems involves restricting access to valuable resources through the issuance of tokens, granting holders rights to use these goods. These tokens are assumed, often without much evidence, to have intrinsic value or provide security for future needs. In a common pool, this function is mirrored by the ability to store and remember valuable resources, including commitments to those resources. Instead of physical or digital currency, a pool of commitments maintains a curation that represents the group's collective intentions and resources. Now let's look at what is called the unit of account. When we say a dollar is worth a dollar, we are pointing to something economists often gloss over: money as a tautology. In other words, a dollar is commonly taken to be worth $1 simply because the issuing authority declares it so, and everyone else abides by that convention. Money issued by a central government, like the US dollar, does have real purchasing power. People accept it for goods and services, but this acceptance at its core relies on two forms of enforcement. One, legal enforcement, when governments levy taxes in their own currency. If you owe taxes in US dollars, you have a built-in reason to accept and seek dollars. Two, social convention. Because everyone around you also uses dollars, the simplest way to exchange value, or to buy groceries or to get paid, is to do the same. From a purely logical standpoint, though, saying a dollar is worth a dollar doesn't shed much light on why it has that worth, beyond "that's just how we do things." This is what we mean by tautological. It's a circular explanation. A dollar is worth $1 because we treat it as such, and we treat it as such because a dollar is worth $1. When an entire economy uses one currency, like the dollar, as its main unit of account, all prices get expressed in dollar terms. This simplifies transactions across many goods and services, but it can also mask the underlying reality of where the dollar's value comes from enforcement and convention. It also means that the relative prices of goods and services are forced into alignment with how the dollar is issued and managed, regardless of local or community-specific needs. In a pool of commitments, the unit of account isn't automatically $1. Instead, value is determined by the particular resources in the pool and the relationships among them. Imagine a shared basket with different kinds of commitments. For example, hours of carpentry work, bundles of firewood, baskets of produce, tutoring sessions. The pool's community, or the pool's smart contract in a digital setting, decides how many units of carpentry equals so many units of firewood, produce, or tutoring directly in terms of one another. That is, 1 hour of carpentry equals 2 bundles of firewood. 1 basket of produce equals 30 minutes of tutoring. And so on. Each item's relative price can shift over time as new resources enter or as seasonal needs change. These relative values can be based on many things, like the energy and time or scarcity required to produce or deliver those resources, or the seasonal needs of the community. There's no single yardstick, like the dollar, overriding every exchange. Instead, the pool creates a relative value index, otherwise known as a price, based on supply, demand, and consensus among participants. Crucially, this frees communities from the one-size-fits-all logic of everything must be converted into dollars. Instead, the pool's internal exchange rates, or prices, arise from the actual resources and needs on the ground. If desired, a community can still tie those relative values back to external currency. E.g., so many units is roughly equal to $5, but they are not obligated to anchor themselves exclusively to one currency. In short, conventional money is a single currency used as a universal measure, and a dollar is worth a dollar by enforcement and convention. But pools of commitments are a more direct, dynamic measure of value which emerges from the actual goods and services in circulation, letting exchange rates evolve over time and in response to the real conditions of the community. Finally, a medium of exchange, in traditional monetary systems, is a tangible or digital bearer instrument, such as a coin or token, used as a stand-in for goods and services. In contrast, a pool facilitates exchange through a cultivated space of mutual agreements and relationships. Commitments are exchanged directly within the pool, bypassing the need for a singular intermediary object. Let's look at how centralization in monetary systems can become deeply entrenched and lead to the loss of local autonomy. Global monetary dominance has happened in many ways, but a significant factor was global trade, particularly the reliance on just a few major currencies, the foremost among them being the US dollar, to purchase key commodities like oil. Anyone wanting to buy from international markets is effectively forced to use that currency or convert their own. Because nearly every nation needs these reserve currencies, the institutions that issue and support them, such as the US Federal Reserve, the IMF, and the World Bank, can set terms that include interest rates and structural adjustment programs. Countries that do not comply risk being cut off from global markets. Access becomes restricted, and dependence is enforced. A small group of banks and financial actors decides who can open accounts, secure loans, or tap into credit in the dominant currency. Those who do not comply with the system may face sanctions or be denied crucial funds, leaving local alternatives underdeveloped or illegal. Once nations and businesses worldwide rely on a single currency, the issuing country can freely produce that currency and collect fees, interest, or seigniorage at a level that would be unsustainable for smaller economies. This setup funnels steady wealth back to the center. Over time, large corporations and financial institutions exploit this advantage to buy out competitors, merge into powerful conglomerates, or engage in horizontal shareholding, enabling them to profit across multiple industries. A few massive players then control vast pools of resources, while community-based resource coordination methods such as seed saving, rotating labor, and communal grazing are marginalized or deemed illegal since they do not operate within sanctioned monetary channels. From this perspective, monetary centralization should not be seen as a random misbehavior, but as an expected outcome of a system that rewards power concentration and penalizes those who seek independence. Techniques that maintain this dynamic often appear to be unethical or isolated instances, yet they arise naturally from a design that enforces top-down control. Throughout history, we see various tactics that are aptly called colonial methods, such as outlawing indigenous practices, enforcing exclusive currency use for taxation, burdening communities with high-interest loans, privatizing common resources, imposing expensive licensing requirements, inflating costs through currency manipulation, favoring monopolies by shaping regulations, patenting life forms to monetize genetic resources, overregulating communities in the name of safety or consumer protection, extracting fees through mandatory channels, promoting dependence by undermining local markets, and criminalizing resistance whenever communities attempt their own resource coordination systems. It becomes clear that these tactics are not simply the work of a handful of bad actors exploiting an otherwise fair setup. Instead, they emerge from a centralized monetary structure designed to channel resources toward a few power brokers. Even ordinary officials or businesses often carry out these tactics because the system itself rewards and normalizes such behavior. Corruption or exploitation does not merely stem from a small group of evildoers. Normal people can enact this same extraction pattern if they operate within a centralized framework that remains profitable for the powerful. In turn, the same structural outcomes repeat on a global scale. Major nodes in the forms of banks, corporations, and states continue to siphon resources from smaller communities that lack the leverage to resist. Today, in looking at the underlying protocols for resource coordination, we can see them expressed in the global monetary systems and used along with tactics for the centralization of power. The network of money and control across the planet looks like a spider web, feeding very few massive central nodes, in which each agreement or pool connects those who would sell their goods and services for money from those who have most of it. The concentration of power is similar to massive overlapping pools forming one massive network of pools controlled by very few companies and their shareholders, much like the cancerous pumpkin that didn't know when to stop growing in Reflection 1. We carry within us and our communities the enduring heritage of our ancestors and ecosystems, systems rooted in cooperation, reciprocity, and shared abundance. Yet the legacy of centralized monetary traditions, steeped in fear and domination since the Roman Empire, continues to shape our world. Colonial methods and modern shareholder systems have mastered the art of curating vast pools of resources, assigning value, restricting access, and profiting from exchanges, all while enclosing the commons in exclusive, controlled domains. Under this system, we are funneled into using national currencies and specific markets as the only means of exchange, concentrating resources and power. Understanding that these colonial methods are embedded features of how modern finance works clarifies why local practices like rotating labor associations hold more than mere cultural or historical significance. They are genuine lifelines that help communities preserve autonomy, foster reciprocity, and cultivate shared abundance. Shared reflections. Are you a parasite? We are all parasitic from some vantage point. In what relationships and ecosystems do you take more than you give? Consider the role of parasites in ecosystems and their potential to evolve into symbiotic partners. What lessons can human economic systems learn from this transformation about managing exploitative relationships and fostering mutual benefit? When is some centralization healthy and when is it unhealthy? How do your individual decisions reflect the intentions of your entire body made up of living cells and organisms? How do your individual decisions reflect the intentions of your other people, like your family? Reflect on how systems may restrict access to resources and limit the creation of alternative pools. When can our ability to pool commitments in a decentralized way provide more equitable and resilient alternatives, and when can it lead to problems? What is the difference between a healthy steward and a parasite? Stewardship in ecosystems and social systems often involves maintaining balance and ensuring sustainable resource distribution. How do you see the protocols of Mueria and Dorme embodying these responsibilities? And how could they be applied in your own life?